Bing bong. I'm back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast, where I'm bringing you another banger of a Tuesday night Twitter space. I got cut off a little bit in the middle, but we prevail here at Green Candle. So be sure to be tuned in. Remember that this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And smash that subscribe button. Rate it 5 stars. Tell a friend to tell a friend. I'm trying to grow the Spotify listener base. So if you're listening on Spotify, smash the subscribe button. And let's get into the show. Whoosh.
But yeah, man, a lot of crazy stuff in the market. It's been a little bit. Our schedules have not lined up here recently. So yeah, man. Let's hear a general overview. I think it's been like a month maybe since we've last spoke. So
yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. So let's hear it, man. Let's hear the riff.
I mean, where do you want to start, Brandon?
Well, let's start. You gave me this title about the questioning the U.S. strength and inflation reaccelerating, dude. So do you think inflation is starting to reaccelerate here, or do you think we've nipped it in the bud?
Shameless plug here, Brandon. Shameless plug here. But so I just finished a Substack yesterday, which I mean will probably kind of be what this is around. But it was by far the longest Substack that I have ever written. A lot of information in there. But so I guess we'll start with the inflation question, right? And so, you know, actually, let me just give me 2 seconds here. I'm going to pull up some data just because things change on a day-to-day basis. But so until I get that done, because this one's only put out monthly, we'll start with the University of Michigan consumer inflation expectations over the next 5 to 10 years. And that came in last month, and mean expectations of inflation over the next 5 to 10 years came in at like 6.1%, which is like one of the highest readings in 30 years. And so, you know, this is significant in and of itself, because if people think that prices are going to be higher in the future, what are they going to do? They're going to pull forward demand. And, I guess I'll bomb the nest, but, I kind of did some, analysis on this, kind of looking at, you know, what Lord Keynes would refer to as the marginal propensity to consume, which, you know, sounds fancy, but it's very basic. It's just the nominal change in consumption divided by the nominal change in disposable income. And, in theory, this should be between 0 and 1, but it can actually fall negative. It can be over 1 in certain instances, like, you know, through the utilization of credit, et cetera, which can actually cause the marginal propensity to consume to be over 1. But it's kind of a good gauge of how much are people spending out of every dollar of disposable income. And right now that's around 90 cents, and that's up in the nest now. And what you kind of see is that the marginal propensity to consume has a big impact on, you know, or tends to follow consumer inflation expectations. Because like I said, if consumers think that inflation is going to be high in the future, they're going to pull forward all of that demand to today. So given this, you know, right now consumers are essentially spending 90 cents of every dollar on consumption. The other 10 cents goes to savings. And you could probably see that in the depressed, how depressed savings rates are. But I do think that that in and of itself is going to be a large kind of contributor to consumption. Moving on to the next thing. And again, this isn't, you know, the end all be all metric. But the other aspect is five-year inflation swaps. Those are at 254 basis points. And so, again, that's a very similar metric to 5 to 10 year inflation expectations, because, a five-year inflation swap is the expected inflation over the next 5 to 10 years. And, you know, that's 54 basis points above the Fed's target. And it never goes to let's say, even during the very peak of inflation, I think it was around 280 basis points. And so, or maybe 290 might have been the high, but I mean, we're sitting only 40 basis points away from that currently, right? And so, I mean, there has been a massive kind of reexurgence and expected expectations of inflation. And I think that if, and I'll land the plane here, but I think that if you dig deeper, you're seeing that in the bond market as well. That's why the 10-year selling off, which means yields moving higher. That's why the, actually the entire yield curve today sold off. So, I do think that there's now this expectation of very robust economic growth to the point that it might be fueling inflation. So, that's kind of what we're seeing on the inflation front. And then, the final aspect that I'll add to that is, I mean, there's, a positive output gap. And I know me and you talked with Garrett about that, this kind of nuance of measuring the output gap. I don't like the CBOE's estimate. I recall him also kind of agreeing with me on that. So I run my own estimate of the output gap. And, currently that's sitting at about 5%, almost 5% of GDP, which means that obviously real GDP is significantly over potential. So we're operating over capacity. And kind of the last thing that I'll add on here, because this is to it, is I took the output gap and then I kind of compared it to, demand pull versus cost push inflation, and just very high level. Demand pull is, too much money chasing too few goods, and cost push inflation is, when you have constraints on the supply curve. So whether it be through things like the, inability to get access to inputs, et cetera. But usually a high output gap is followed by, demand pull inflation. But we're still having a lot of this cost push inflation that's, being driven by geopolitical issues and the price of inputs increasing. So, nevertheless, it does look like both demand is going to be somewhat substantial, and I think that you saw that in the retail sales. I mean, I know it's seasonally adjusted, but that massively beat expectations, coming in at 0.4. I think expectation was 0.1, if I recall correctly. And so, obviously that's, susceptible to revisions, et cetera, but in all actualities, markets don't really give a shit about revisions. They care more about that like preliminary headline number. And so, yeah, I mean, there was a massive beat to the upside. Retail sales ex autos month over month were like 0.5%. So you are starting to see that, pull forward of demand, and I think that that's probably going to be something that continues. So I'll land it there. I kind of droned on for a bit, but I think that's a good launching pad.
Yeah, now we got David up here, so welcome, David. But yeah, I mean, I do think it is interesting that we're seeing the rate cut, and I think we discussed it right around when the last rate cut occurred. It was 50 basis points. We had Elizabeth Warren calling for like a 75 point basis or basis point cut, excuse me. So with that, I mean, it seems like there's more cuts being priced into the market before the end of the year. Now, with inflation seemingly almost priced in again, do you think that that will ramp it up even more dramatically going into 25? Is that a worry of yours? And yeah.
Sorry, ramp what up?
Ramp inflation up even more than we're seeing right now, because it seems like it's not under control. So a cut wouldn't be doing any positives.
Yeah, I mean, I will echo this. I think that in the long run, right, in the long run, which is very ambiguous in economics, but in the long run, I do think that rates are lower, but kind of in the short run, let's say anything under 5 years, where we are now, at least in terms of economic growth, I think 50 basis points was terrible. Today we actually, Canada ended up having a rate cut. They cut by 50 basis points, so they're all the way down at 375 basis points. So, significant kind of, I'm not saying they're going back to the zero, but they're heading much lower. But again, like, Canada's inflation rate's now at 1.6%. I think economic growth is right around 1%, very, very, very weak. And so, when you're kind of looking at that scenario where, you've hit your target, maybe even heading towards deflation, at the rate of change in which Canada's actually seeing inflation decelerate, rate cuts are probably necessary at a very rapid clip. But when you're kind of looking at where we've been in the United States, I think that the 50 basis points from the Fed was overblown. Again, I do think that the natural rate will be lower, but I just think at this point in time, it was going to be a bad decision. And after they did this, and it's on my page, like the first thing that I said is like, we're going to have a reacceleration of inflation. Like economic data continues to come in hot, and you can look at that on like Citi Economic Surprise. I'm not sure if that data is available like publicly, but I know both on Icon and Bloomberg, we have it there. And that's just kind of measuring like what was the actual print less the estimates, like the median estimate that was put out by economists divided by the standard deviation of forecast errors. And so that kind of gives you, okay, are we beating to the upside? Are we beating to the downside? And then the magnitude is, how much are you beating kind of relative to that historical forecast error? And, the United States is positive. And it turned positive about a month ago for the first time in 5 months, even though data was still somewhat robust. And so, like, kind of pointing at all of these things, the economy is accelerating at a very rapid clip. And so, yeah, I mean, I just think that 50 basis points was completely kind of ridiculous. 25 probably would have been better for the market, I think. I think it would have digested more, and you probably wouldn't have had that reacceleration in inflation. But, that's where we are now. That's seems like the current paradigm. Like you would not want to be long bonds here. Because, I think that yields are probably going to continue to go up, right?
David, welcome, man. Do you have anything to add to that? If you can speak.
But just
Yeah, give me one moment. Go ahead, dear.
the one thing that I wanted to say, I put something up in the Nest. This is a little bit more mathematical, but it kind of goes to show like where we are because Canada cut rates today. So I was looking at some stuff there. You can kind of model where the yield curve should be. It's called the Nelson-Siegel. And so if you use like the Nelson-Siegel factor, like you can essentially model various shapes of the yield curve, normal, inverted, et cetera. And they essentially use three parameters to fit the yield curve. And so you can kind of easy. It's easier to kind of model out than like more complex models of trying to factor like where yield should be under a steady state. And so, when you're kind of looking at that, at least even in Canada, right, they need the short end to fall by about 100 basis points, and the long end to rise around 50 or 60 for them to actually be able to achieve that steady, like that. A normal upward sloping term structure for interest rates. And so, I think that they're going to have m much more significant cuts than what we're going to have in the United States. Obviously, in the United States, for us to kind of return to a normal term structure, that would be even more significant. I'll model that when I get home. But I think that just goes to show, where we are, at least in the inflation paradigm, right? And I mean, you've started to have things, I haven't really talked about supply chains, but you've started to have things on the supply chain front deteriorate, like the Fed's global supply chain index is starting to increase again. That's following changes in the contribution of supply-driven inflation, So I'll throw that up in the nest just so that people can look at it. So that's supply chain pressure index relative to supply driven inflation. And so the supply chain index is measured on a standard deviation basis. So zero would be normal, and then anything, plus one standard deviation would be obviously statistically significant. When you're starting to look at the contribution of the breakdown of inflation, I'll throw that up as well. I mean, the largest contributor still kind of continues to be supply-driven inflation, right? And so, yeah, I mean, it just depends if we can unkink the inelasticity of the aggregate supply curve, right? And if we can do that, then inflation will come down. But if on the back end of that you have this massive revamp in demand, I mean, again, supply is just not going to be able to keep up. So I think that that's kind of the current period where we are.
And a fairly simplistic question here, but you can
Disagree,
go.
David.
Okay, thank you there, dear point. But essentially, do you think that that's going to translate into CPI data? I mean, currently we've been seeing a fairly moderate CPI, and evidently I know it's lagging in that respect. But nonetheless, I just want to understand primarily where you're seeing the resurgence in inflationary pressure and how it translates to economic activity in that sense, specifically CPI as well.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with everything that David said.
It was a question. It was a question.
David, I never know like when it's a question or a statement.
That it was clearly a question. It was simplistic too there. Come on, dear. Stop
What was your
pulling me under
question?
the
I was
bus. Does
responding
it
to a message.
translate to CPI? Motherfucker over here, right?
Obviously, it translates to CPI. It's literally the decomposition of CPI, David. God. People say that there's no stupid questions, but that was a stupid question.
Well, okay, then
It literally said
why haven't we seen it?
contribution
Why
to
haven't we
headline.
seen that
No,
recycling then? So the
David,
question is, why haven't we seen the
Putain,
recycling inside CPI data?
let me finish the Putain. C'est le. Anyways, so,
Dear, let's not degrade into our phone calls here. God.
Tabarnak. But anyways, David, it literally says headline year over year, and this man then proceeds to ask me if this is going to have any contribution. I love you, David. Even though you're kind of like Forrest Gump, to be honest, but.
Okay, calm yourself. So then the big question that led into this, right, was do we see the quote unquote soft landing as a plausibility? And arguably, do you, like you already referenced that the rate hikes, rate cuts, sorry, were a bit aggressive by the Fed, but nonetheless, I think that they were fairly moderate, especially in the increasingly hot economy that we have, right? Quote unquote. And so, by virtue, I think that like this soft landing, in your perspective, is with this recycling of inflation, is there a possibility for that? Quote unquote. I don't necessarily give too much credence to that, but I think that I'd love to hear your opinion there.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that they can manage a soft landing. I mean, I think that the reason that you are having a re-acceleration in inflation is like, as I mentioned, it's because the economy is hot, right? Like the I mean, just think about it. What probably by the end of the year will be growing somewhere in the ballpark of like 4.5, 5% nominal, right? Depending on where inflation is, right? So I think that that is extremely hot relative to where we have been historically. And I mean, that's kind of always why I look at the output gap. And again, but I guess, yeah, kind of before it got cut off, what I was just saying is, I mean, the reason that I think that inflation will reaccelerate is because of how strong economic growth has been. But yeah, that's kind of where it got cut off. And I was just saying, yeah, while the output gap is theoretical, I do think that it explains a lot, right? So, yeah, that's kind of where we were.
Yeah, and
Thoughts?
I think if we're looking at like some of the largest like relative news in relation to what you were saying, in relative costs for consumers, like on aggregate, there's the majority of goods that are being purchased that are discretionary and are non-discretionary as well, and that they're just essentially not able to appropriately afford the costs of life in that respect, and it's not appropriately represented within CPI. And that's where we can go into the nuance between the methodology between CPI and how it truly depicts inflationary pressures within the economy. But nonetheless, right?
Yeah. And I guess moving forward, it's just how much has data surprised to the upside? And so, you know, I threw that in the nest. And so that's looking at economic surprise, which is put out by Citigroup, which we talked about. I mean, math is pretty simple. Actual data less the median kind of estimate divided by historical forecast error. And then unemployment surprise, which is not calculated by Citi. I actually had to do that myself using a very similar methodology. And while the unemployment surprise is still negative, even with Citi, what shouldn't be looked at is the actual value of whether or not it's positive or negative, but at the magnitude of the move. That gives you a much more kind of nuanced look of how much is data surprising to the upside, kind of relative to it's kind of historical, it's historical forecast error. And so, I mean, like we've seen a massive move in unemployment, almost moving positive in terms of surprise, but it's more, like I said, the magnitude of that move is much more telling of just how strong the economy is. And obviously on the other side of that, you're just looking at, you know, hikes and cuts priced 1 year ahead. And kind of going back to the very beginning of the year, you know, you almost had 200 basis points of cuts priced in over the next year. And I know it's hard to tell on that graph, but now we've almost taken out 100 basis points of cuts, 1 year ahead. So it does seem like now the market's coming towards this expectation of, like, the economy is relatively hot, and there's no need really for emergency rate cuts. I mean, like, there's other things that are going on within the economy that I think are very interesting, that I'll kind of highlight. One being kind of capital market skewness. And, you know, this is essentially just the mathematical breakdown. And it's also skewness is kind of a leading indicator of the business cycle. And so what you're essentially looking at is the variance in individual stock returns at any given moment. And so that kind of measures this idea of cross-sectional uncertainty within financial markets. And then, I mean, if anybody wants to go through the math, they can, but I'm not going to sit here and bore people with, boring mathematical concepts of how you calculate skewness and all of that, but anybody who wants to read that can. And so, I mean, just based on that, it does seem like we're in a period of reacceleration of the business cycle. And, you know, something else that I put out today was on value added within the S&P, which, you know, is currently about one standard deviation over the mean. And, you know, what this model is looking at is operating profits, capital expenditures, working capital, and, all of those kinds of things that go into that model are showing that there is tremendous value actually being added by these companies currently. And that's historically kind of tracked S&P returns, right? Because, you know, when you're investing, one of the most important things is, you know, how much value are being added by companies. and, you know, value creation, because, you know, if companies are truly creating value, then they're kind of not entirely getting a moat, but, you know, it actually adds to expected returns for investors, right? Because, I mean, value added is extremely, extremely important. If companies are truly adding value, or are they just kind of financializing? And so, I mean, we're seeing huge value added within the S&P in aggregate. And so, I mean, I think that as well is going to be a huge kind of momentum boost to equity markets, despite some people being worried about expectations and where earnings are coming in. If you actually look at the breakdown, I think thus far companies that have reported for this quarter, it's somewhere in like the ballpark or the vicinity of, you know, I think now 75% of companies have actually beat expectations. And so, you know, the problem is, I think even when you're getting these sell-offs, even if companies beat expectations, almost like what we saw with NVIDIA last quarter, is, you know, people are wanting the outliers of those estimates in terms of, you know, where EPS is coming in, where earnings are coming in. And obviously you're not going to get that all the time, but they are beating kind of median expectations. So, you know, taking out outliers within that. But yeah, I mean, I still think that, you know, equity market values aren't all that stretched. And I haven't put this out, but it's in the Substack, and, you know, kind of looking at where we are within what's driving equity markets higher, and it just continues to be multiple expansion from PE ratios, so price to earning ratios. You're getting a lot of PE expansion, which is, you know, lifting the S&P, kind of contributing massively to the rally that we've been seeing. But yeah, I'm not sure if David has any thoughts there.
Well, primarily, this is the aggregate picture, evidently. And I was going to ask you, do you have specific sectors within the S&P that you feel like are potentially ripe for outperformance and potential weaknesses in that respect? Like, evidently, we've seen in the last few quarters, tech being fairly, like, they've had subdued months and or weeks of performance, but they're still considered some of the strongest functions of the S&P. And then when we're looking at the, like, let's say Mag 7, right, the classic bobblehead statement, and how they're pushing the S&P further than essentially other companies, right? And so your central views on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that consumer discretionary staples, transportation, I know FedEx had kind of a disappointment, but I mean, nevertheless, EPS growth is still positive on a year-over-year basis. Again, that's in the Substack. I haven't posted those charts yet. But if you look at kind of the two largest transportation companies, being FedEx and being UPS, you know, and you kind of give a 25% additional weighting to FedEx if you're doing like a weighted average between the two. And the way that I kind of come up at that 25% is, you know, air freight for FedEx is about 25% larger than what it is for UPS. So they have a much larger air cargo business. But, you know, those are kind of a barometer of what we're seeing in the economy. So I think the transportation staples, discretionary, I think healthcare as well, because there's a lot of inelasticity of demand within healthcare, and pharmaceuticals, especially in things like, you know, like people who make insulin, et cetera, because despite the price of insulin, I mean, to somewhat, I'm not saying that insulin can go up, you know, to infinity, but insulin is something that is relatively inelastic. And then, you know, you have things like if you need insulin, you need insulin. But, and then you have things like tobacco stocks, which, you know, as well have some level of inelasticity of demand. If you're addicted to tobacco, you're going to pay, you know, the cost of whatever a pack of cigarettes or a pack of Zyn is, despite the price, right? And I mean, Zyn's price has increased it drastically. Like I'm in South Carolina, my home state, and I know, like when Zen first came out, it was about $3 a can. And now it's almost $9 where I am. So you've had, you know, an increase by factor of 3. And, you know, demand is still relatively robust for Zen. I mean, you know, Philip Morris reported, I believe, yesterday. And, you know, Zen, I think in 2019 or 2020, whenever it was released, they were doing about 50 million cans, and now it's at 532 million, despite, you know, almost a 3x price increase in the cost of Zen. So, you know, things like that as well, I think, are going to do well. And then these haven't done all that fantastic recently, but I still think that commodity producers are relatively undervalued, and I still like defense stocks. I think those are still going to do very well, just given geopolitical risks. So those sectors, I think, are probably going to be strong performers throughout the remainder of the year.
Yeah, and I definitely like defense stocks as well. I think that when we're looking at just the military complex is always going to have a specific budget. And as we discussed earlier on a phone call, like it's always going to be one, a slightly underappreciated sector, but at the same time, one that offers a fairly interesting perspective within it. But yeah.
Yeah, and then I think that there's the whole private growth story, like private sector demand, I think. I mean, kind of shifting somewhat away from equity markets, but we can always go back to them. And probably still kind of with this inflation theme, I think private sector demand is going to be relatively strong. So if you strip out from the expenditure identity of GDP, which is consumption plus investment plus government spending, plus net exports equals GDP, given the expenditure identity. You know, both C and I, so if you add consumption and investment, which is kind of a barometer of private sector demand on a year-over-year basis, are rising very rapidly. The credit impulse, which is new credit, the new issuance of credit as a percentage of GDP, also increasing. And so, you know, there is this idea of the utilization of credit in the aggregate being a kind of as that expands, will lead to more and more private sector demand. And so, again, haven't put that out in the Substack, but I mean, I think that that's going to continue to kind of support private sector demand as well as just how strong the new issuance of credit has been. So, and I guess back to capital markets, at least on the private side, like if you're a company that's not able to get financing through a bank for whatever reason, I think that lends a very interesting hand to the syndicated loan market. And so, you know, syndicated loans and kind of private credit, volumes have been very robust. And, you know, if you're looking at junior capital and hybrid capital solutions, kind of with the backdrop of this potential still for higher for longer interest rate environment, at least on the investment grade side, you know, fundamentally sound businesses are being constrained with higher cash debt service requirements and lower levels of senior debt capacity. And junior capital, at least in the private credit side, can help relieve those kind of obligations and allow for, you know, continued growth for these companies that just weren't able to get loans, at least on the bank side. And so I think private credit is probably going to be something that does well as well, and syndicated loan markets. So I think both of those as well, very interesting opportunities.
Yeah, and the data would definitely agree with you, as you probably have already seen. But if we're looking at commercial bank loans distributed to companies, small, medium, and large, versus that of private credit loans being distributed, we're actually seeing a moderation within your conventional bank credit distribution versus that of your private sector. And the private sector is actually taking a larger, like, breadth of the actual credit demand, which is fairly interesting at the same time. One, less profitable for banks, very interesting on the private credit function as well. If we just look at like the IPO market, right, it's theoretically a healthy environment to actually say, I'll start an IPO and I'll go for a public listing in that respect, in order to then receive more capital. But essentially, your private sector has been so strong that it's subdued any forms of IPOs. Like, usually we would see a fairly robust IPO market, but essentially a lot of these companies, private companies per se, have been withholding their actual initial offerings in that respect to essentially, I guess, continue on the private sector and develop their functions in the private sector because of how easy the private sector has been. Sorry for that little jumbled mess there, but essentially you get the point. Like, there's a huge capturing of the private market essentially within these companies, and we have two functions within it. One, it's less distributions of regular conventional bank credit to these companies, and then two, it's a lack of robustness within the IPO market, which is fairly interesting considering S&P being so high, right?
Yeah, I mean, but you're starting to see like kind of the coming back of underwriting. Like, I know that there's been a lot of high yield and investment grade credit underwritten. I think it's like the highest the last 18 months. And so you are starting to kind of see this reemergence that, which obviously is possible, you know, kind of lending standards starting to ease, financial conditions are easing. And, you know, one other thing that's very interesting is the Chicago Fed puts out the Economic Activity Index. And, you know, you want to look at the 3-month moving average. So if the 3-month moving average is, 0.7 after an economic contraction, that means that you're going into economic expansion. And if it is negative 0.7 after an economic contraction or an economic expansion, that means that you're going into an economic contraction. And right now, that's still signaling signs of robustness within the economy, within the U.S. So, I mean, I think that there's, and like I said, I mean, financial conditions remain relatively easy. And so, I mean, I think that all of these things are kind of pointing towards the fact that financial markets, just in the aggregate, are going to continue to do extremely well. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a place that I would particularly be trying to look for things to short. So,
yeah, the interesting question in that respect, right, because it's grown to roughly like the private credit market has grown to roughly like $1.9 trillion. And it's essentially the risk parameters that are associated to the actual position that you'd be underlaying. I think many participants have been actually signaling that there's an extraordinarily high risks in relation to in relation to this. And so by virtue, it's whether the risk is worth the reward. And there's some debate in associations to that. Like, we're seeing some forms of deterioration within the levered portion, and that's where it becomes fairly interesting. And so fundamentally, when we're looking at the risk profile, it needs to be appropriately like calculated, right?
Yeah. And then, all right. I know you got to wrap up here in a second, Brandon, but just another shout out to another brand that just came on online called Turning Point Brands, not Charlie Kirk's Turning Point, but so Turning Point Brands, they own Stoker's and Zig-Zag. They just released a nicotine pouch. I think it's been out for a while, but it's the first time I've ever seen it, at least in like QTs. which is a gas station in like North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. But they've now come out with a nicotine pouch called Free, and they are offering 15 milligram pouches. And they also sell pouches in like little bags where you can get like 100 pouches, which is very, lucrative for people who like nicotine pouches. And obviously the dosage just being significantly higher, you know, almost double the highest. They sell a 12 milligram, which is exactly double. And then the other one's slightly over double. The highest milligram offering that Zyn has, unless you're throwing in like 3 or 4 Zyn pouches at a time, I think also makes them very lucrative. And those aren't too expensive. I think they're like $3.99 a can. So I've been trying those out here for a while as well, just to get higher milligrams of nicotine without having to do like multiple Zyn pouches at once. But, you know, Zyn, I still think, remains kind of the queen of the nicotine pouches, you know. I mean, 532 million cans is massive, especially if they were only doing 50 million back in 2019. So,
my God, we just got a full Zyn breakdown. But, all right, guys. Sorry, I had to cut this short and I had the little mishap in the beginning. But I'll combine these and I'll put it on my podcast feed as well. And it'll drop Monday. So be on the lookout for that. But yeah, we'll start getting back in the swing of things with this. It's just been crazy couple months for me. But hopefully towards the end of the year, get more of a routine. So, all right, boys, appreciate it. And, stay classy, San Diego.